Kick the tires and light the fires.
Light everything on fire.
Well, there's one thing that I learned from this movie, and that is burn it all to the ground.
It's good advice for a lot of things.
Yeah. So, how are you?
I'm good. A little tired. I just ate a little pack of fruit snacks here.
Mm-hmm.
I got a whole box, Costco-sized box of Welch's fruit snacks.
May I inquire as to the purported fruit flavor?
Oh, these are the mixed fruit. I always go for the mixed fruit. I don't want to pigeonhole myself into just like strawberry or something.
Okay. I mean, I don't like that because there are a lot of things in the mix that you might not appreciate.
I mean, the orange is not great, but...
Mm-hmm. And what about the grape?
Grape's fine. The grape has a slightly thicker viscosity, but it still tastes good.
That's what I always look for in things, is the viscosity.
Viscosity. Well, everything has a viscosity. It's just a matter of whether it is a pleasing viscosity.
Mm-hmm.
It's got off on a weird start.
Yeah.
How's your day, week, whatever, month going?
Fine. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought I would have so much time this week to get through things and get things done and be ahead of the curve on stuff. And the reality...
Sorry, Wednesday.
Yeah. The reality is the week's almost over. How did that happen?
Yeah, you know... Like, it feels like yesterday I had a month to finish this project, and now I've got like a week and a half, so it'd be super helpful if my software decided to actually open now.
Did you fix your Nuke problem where it was like, hey, you've got a disk plugged in, I'm not going to open?
No, it just doesn't, I guess that project, it has too many things in it, so I made a new project and then moved on.
So it works.
It's the benefit of a modular workflow. I can jump steps here and there and skip things around, and I don't know.
Have you reached the stage where you're opening that project, rendering it out, and then cutting it together in another project?
Well, the main purpose of using the Nuke Studio there is for conforming and workflow related things, which I can do in other places just much more slowly. So I reassembled the timeline in Avid and then kicked out a new XML of the updated stuff. And then I brought that into a new Nuke Studio project, which doesn't have any of the bad things that make it angry. So now I can do the rest of the stuff from there.
So I have a question for you. How many words do you think will be in the blog post about this workflow?
It's not even worth bringing up because this is...
Never going to do it again.
This is me punting on the original workflow that I already have there. So.
I had a weird Nuke bug today where I was doing a spline warp. For the audience members who don't know, that's basically like drawing some points, and then you can drag the points around, and the distance between the original source and your destination is how far you're gonna move those pixels. So it's a good way to like distort surfaces and stuff like that, and especially for organic shapes, because you can draw anything you want to and then drag it around. It is about as stable as two hedgehogs holding up a toaster covered in mayonnaise, and then a bookcase is wobbling over that, and then the hedgehogs are trying to carry it across the room. That is my assessment of spline warp's stability.
That's a very peculiar metaphor.
Yeah, well, you know,
I might need some sort of iMessage sticker pack to explain that to me.
Yeah, furniture on hedgehogs. So the problem with that situation is unstable at the best of times. But today it did a weird thing where I was drawing a spline and it froze right after I did it, and I went to do undo, but instead of undoing the spline, it undid my last spline connection. And so then it was like some weird non-shape, and it wouldn't let me delete it or delete any of the other shapes or change anything else or touch anything else. Everything was just completely unmovable. And I tried restarting Nuke and opening the project again and all that jazz. And I was just like, nope, you're not going to, it is just permanently broken. It's stuck in some sort of a state where it cannot do anything anymore. And so I had to delete the node and start over on the splines from scratch. So that was an exciting use of my time.
Hmm. Couldn't close the shape.
Nope. Couldn't close the deal. So, you know, these are tools of a modern era. Let us go back to a time where people would set garbage bags on fire and melt plastic and bubble gum, and we'll talk about John Carpenter's The Thing.
This is a movie from 1982. It's probably the best thing that we've watched in our themed October scary monster movies.
Is that a pun?
Oh no! Well, I guess everything's a pun when the movie's literally called The Thing.
Yeah, stuff and things.
Although when I think of The Thing, I think of that or the Adventure Time. What is it? Lemon Grab Thingy Mabob? Who did The Thing?
Who did The Thing?
The Thing.
Oh yeah, when he gets angry because somebody put
The dog buns, yeah.
Yeah. That's not first and foremost for me. It was kind of interesting though when I went to go watch it, and I have an Apple TV and a Siri remote, and I was like, I want to watch The Thing. And then it brought up a list of multiple selections, because as you might imagine, The Thing is kind of a generic name for a movie. And the first result was Fantastic Four, because there is The Thing in it. And then there was a stream of other nonsensical, totally unrelated to what I wanted selections that either had some character named The Thing or had Thing in the title. Not even The in the title, but sometimes just Thing. And you were just like, I don't, why can't I get the one I want? And I even
did you get like Adam's Family and then like The Sweetest Thing?
I think Sweetest Thing might have been in there, but I can't remember. But, you know, I even tried John Carpenter's The Thing, thinking I needed to be more specific. And then it was like, nope, nothing for that one. And so I eventually just typed in this ridiculous thing until I searched through a list that was longer and found it. Because Siri results are helpfully truncated to like the first like 8 or 10 things. And then it's just like, yeah, you're on your own after that. If whatever I thought you said is unfindable for me. So that was an exciting hunting and pecking experience to procure it. And of course, The Thing is based off of a remake, sort of, but not really, of a old black and white movie, The Thing from Another World. Howard Hawks and Kristen Nyby. I think there's an episode of The Incomparables Old Movie Club where they occasionally gather a couple times a year to talk about old movies, and then Steve Lutz does like a prospector voice and goes, "Old Movie Club," and that's a thing that they do. And one of the times they discussed this movie, and it sounded like something I wouldn't want to watch, so I never have.
Did they discuss the original movie?
Yeah, because even that is based on a short story. Called Who Goes There, and the short story has more in common with John Carpenter's The Thing than the Thing from Another World had in common with the short story. And the little novella thing is from the 30s, but it basically follows the whole fear of something that can imitate anything, and that is at the heart of what drives this particular movie. I was going to say The Thing again, but that isn't, it's not helpful. And the other one by Kristen Nyby and Howard Hawks, it's more of like a Frankenstein kind of a thing, only it's a vegetable. But
a vegetable, like they're attacked by a cucumber?
I think it's more of a carrot, but it doesn't really matter. It's listening to people talk about it, and then also listening to John Carpenter's derisive opinion about it and some of the little documentary bits and pieces he's appeared in over the years, it makes me think that I'm not going to pursue that further as a particularly good use of my time. But this movie is very interesting and peculiar and weird, and has like a certain vibe to it that I'm not sure I could picture coming from another director. It is so uniquely John Carpenter that John Carpenter's name appearing before the title is only apt because it is a weird project from start to finish. And while it might have slightly more in common with the novella, I can't imagine that it's anything like the gruesome, grotesque horror show with weird, darkly comedic moments in it, and all that. But it is interesting, and I'd never actually seen the thing because, like, if you watch it on TV, it's all chopped up and gross and really unpleasant. And if you come to it because some friend recommended you watch it, and you don't watch it, you know, under the right conditions, like if you walk in and they're like halfway through it or something like that, then it doesn't really like grip you, I would say, a lot, because, you know, it's really dependent on everything building up over time. So I would recommend pursuing this and watching it from the very beginning. And I would probably lean more towards renting it than anything else. It is available for free on Crackle right now. But you have to watch it with ads that I feel like would be disruptive. So I didn't want to do it. And I don't know if that's also why you rented it, but that was my opinion.
No, I bought it because it's supposed to be a good movie, and I was on my laptop all day, and I knew that if I rented it, it wouldn't be on my Apple TV, because that's, you know, I learned my lesson. That's not how the things work. So I hit the button that would let me look at it over there. Like, I've done that with most of these movies where we're talking about sort of classic horror movies. It's like, yeah, I'm probably not going to regret buying this and having it in my collection, so let's buy it, and then it'll be easy to watch in all of the places, even though, you know, $15 or whatever. But yeah, I had never seen the whole thing either. I had seen parts of it on TV, which I don't even think it's from TV, but you know, you're kind of familiar with the concept and the story. It's kind of part of the culture, and it's been referenced here and there. There's an episode of X-Files that's almost exactly the same as this movie, like disturbingly similar plot and everything. But you know, it's an iconic movie, and on paper, it's everything that I would hate in a movie. You know, like it's very slow and mostly about suspense, and, you know, takes place in the snow and stuff. But I actually love this movie. It's actually really, really enticing for me because it's real characters and real human beings acting like real people, and not really kind of dealing with all of the goofiness that comes with sort of sci-fi movies, especially in the 80s, where people are very kind of over the top. As this is like the polar opposite of our last movie, Predators 2, because that movie nobody acts like a rational human being, and this one everyone does. And I really appreciate how quickly Kurt Russell goes from "What the hell is that?" to "Set it on fire."
I do have to ask you a question though. In your list of things that wouldn't appeal to you on paper, you listed "Takes Place in the Snow." What? What do you have against snow? Is this an Arizona thing?
No, I don't know. It's no, I don't have anything against the snow. Mostly, I think it's probably the same thing I have against Westerns. Just that sort of like in the middle of nowhere, barren environment kind of thing. It just like doesn't really. It limits what you can do, but in a lot of instances, like in this instance in particular, the fact that they're isolated is a big portion of the plot. But a lot of the times, like Westerns, I don't like the way they're set like that. But anyway.
Yeah, well, you know, what if you combined both of those and you had a Western that took place in the snow, like The Revenant? Or like the Quentin Tarantino movie?
Actually, the Quentin Tarantino movie, not as bad because there are humans in it, including Kurt Russell. And Morricone also did the score for that one. I enjoyed that movie more than I enjoyed The Revenant, that's for damn sure. Boy, well, you're not on Letterboxd, but I think I tweeted it too. I saw The Revenant again on TV, HBO.
Yeah, I remember, and I asked why you were pursuing that fruitless endeavor.
You know, I figured I'd give it a second opportunity.
To disappoint?
And, yeah, it did. It disappointed again. It was slow. It was in the snow. It was boring. And you can see all the seams when it's on a small screen.
That's good to know. That's why you need to watch movies in the cinema, Dan.
Well, I did see The Revenant in the cinema. I know, so did I. It because it was boring.
Yeah, but this is one of the interesting things it has in common, because that movie was also hard to make, and the thing was hard to make too. Only I think people complained about it less, seemingly, and got unfortunately less recognition. It was critically panned when the thing came out. Meanwhile, The Revenant is like, oh yeah, best thing since Birdman. And
in the trivia, I was reading a little bit of the trivia on IMDb before we got into this. Apparently, they left a lot of that junk out there in the Arctic, and somebody made a trip down there to go like get a piece of the helicopter that they blew up.
Yeah, well, it's in Stewart, British. Well, outside of Stewart, British Columbia, there's a mining operation that had opened a spot on a trail. There's like one road that goes to this mining place, but then the mine shut down. And so the production guy, the designer, I think his name was something Lloyd. I can't remember. He basically found this impossible place to locate. And then they built everything during the summer, when you could drive in on the dirt road and build it on top of the little dirt mound that was slightly elevated, above everything else. And then, you know, they wait till winter 6 months later to shoot it in the snow. And that's how they got their base. And one of the things I didn't know until I was watching a little behind the scenes documentary that I found on YouTube, which I'm not entirely sure if it's supposed to be on YouTube, in the grand scheme of things that shouldn't be on YouTube but are, they had a whole like side of that filming ground area right behind the set that was all trees, just as far as the eye could see. So what the production designer did is he designed the set so there would be the long like wing of the base that would obscure the trees on that side, and then you'd only see in the other direction. And I think that worked pretty effectively. It does have a weird beginning to this film, though, because it's one of the first things we see after the spaceship and the opening titles, and that area is just a giant glacier with a brown helicopter chasing a dog and a guy trying to shoot it, and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense, and it kind of evokes, I don't know, like Dark Star in some aspects. Have you ever seen that?
No, I don't know what that is.
Oh, it's another Carpenter thing, so.
Well, the spaceship reminded me of Predator a lot, because, you know, another 80s style spaceship landing on Earth thing. And then the flying after the dog made me sad at first. I was like, don't shoot the dog, poor dog. And then
yeah, poor dog.
yeah, but it's interesting. I thought the set design worked really well. I thought it looked real nice. I didn't think for a second that they weren't out in the middle of a snowy middle of nowhere kind of thing.
Yeah, and they when they go to visit the Norwegian base, they are actually filming the destroyed base that they had, their outpost, because that was after they had burned the set, after they shot the final scenes of the film. They went back and did that to the burned set because it just looked like destruction during the day. So yeah. It was an effective production design use of reusing that set that they built over 6 months in the middle of nowhere. And the rest of the stuff was all shot in Universal Studios, including some of the matte paintings of them wandering around outside with the when they go to see the alien ship that's buried in the glacier. They basically just shot them on some white tarps on some grass and from far away. And then they just cut them out and put them in the painting.
It's a pretty good matte painting. There was even some light that changed on the matte painting in one of the shots.
Yeah, it was Alfred Whitlock, who was a old school, big time matte guy from Hitchcock era of I think Birds was his first film, and then he did a bunch of other stuff after that. And so he is a very practiced eye for that stuff by this point in his career. And you know, it's pretty effective. Not something you can say about most matte paintings in the 1980s and early 90s. And I didn't feel like there were some aggressive matte lines around things. It seemed pretty fine for, you know, what it was. They were shot on blue screen for a couple of those, and it worked out okay.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it still didn't look like they were on a set or anything.
No, it looked like a painting.
Yeah. But the... back to the beginning of this film, they have the whole weird thing with the guy chasing the dog, trying to shoot it, trying to kill it. They land in the helicopter. The guy mysteriously blows up his helicopter with a grenade. And this is startling.
Accidentally, of course.
Well, he throws it behind him, which is very strange.
Yeah, it slipped out of his glove. That's mm-hmm. why he tried to dig for it.
Yeah, it that didn't work out well. And so the older guy who works at the base, who seems to be, have been there for a long time. Gary decides to just shoot the guy, because he's a threat. And that is a good choice because that threat would probably have shot everybody else. So, Gary nails him right in the head, right through the eye, I believe. And, the other guy is dead too. The pilot of the plane. And this just leaves the mysterious wolf, well, not wolf, Alaskan Malamute. And so they take the dog in, and the dog just kind of ingratiates itself by wandering around the base for the little first part here of the film.
It's a good dog. Just hanging out under the pool table or ping pong table or whatever.
It's very chill. It wants to just talk to people, and, you know, we had somebody talk to it and just hang out by them and stuff until later on they eventually realize that maybe the dog should be with the other sleigh dogs. And so Clark goes to put the Malamute in with the other station's sled dogs, and then, you know, shuts the little gate thing, and then the dog sits
funny
down.
Thing happens.
Yeah.
That night. I was just thinking about the intro to this, though. It would kind of have been interesting to do just like almost entirely from the American base perspective, just like, you know, instead of like riding along with the helicopter at any given point, just hanging out with Kurt Russell in his little tower there, and then hearing the helicopter come in and circling around their base and hearing gunfire, and then going outside and seeing some crazy dude chasing after a dog and then blowing stuff up and getting shot. Like, that might have been a slightly more interesting way to introduce it, but, you know, it wouldn't be too much different than the way they did it.
Yeah, I do wonder if the movie had hewed more closely to his point of view, if that would have worked out, or more closely, I guess, opposed to the base's point of view, like you had said, because it's sort of superfluous when they go to the other Norwegian base later and to go to the crashed ship later. It doesn't do much other than establish the scale of things to open up the space a little. Like, they get tapes and stuff, and they get paperwork, and they see the ship, and they see the hole they cut in the ice and stuff like that to get the thing out of the ice. But it's not something that you needed to necessarily see in order to believe the weird things that are happening. But that's debatable. And
I think the scene in the Norwegian base certainly added some suspense and some terror for the audience, especially because, you know, like, the guy who's cut his own neck or whatever, that was some pretty brutal stuff, and there was some like slow suspense in there. But if nothing else, it kind of serves the purpose of like establishing that these are normal characters acting like human beings and going like, this is pretty screwed up, I don't know what this is, but we're going to react to it like regular human beings probably would, and then discover some sort of burnt, mutilated body outside and take that back with us in a big tarp.
Yeah, and I'm not saying dispose of the stuff they bring back from there, or to make them not go to those places, but to just show what they brought back from those places would be an alternative way of thinking about it, I suppose. But anyway, they go and they bring back the weird, twisted corpse that they find, and there's nobody else alive there. Everything else is burned or shot or destroyed. The whole base is in shambles, and the thing that they bring back with them looks like it's sort of a fused person. Like, there's sort of two sides of different heads, like, glued sort of together. And
it's like if the T-1000 was made out of actual flesh instead of metal.
Yeah, I mean, it looks very sculptural. It doesn't seem as organic as they probably thought. And, of course, covered in the 80s favorite material, KY jelly.
At least it's pink and gooey.
Yeah, so but they bring it back, and then Wilford Brimley's like, you know, normal organs, totally normal organs, full of normal organs. Look at all the normal organs I'm pulling out of it. Wilford Brimley. You know,
he's doing an autopsy. He did pretty well in that. Just approaching it as a man of science, like, I don't know what this is, but I'm going to cut it open and take a look.
Yeah, well, what I love about that is how quick he is to say normal, because what's outside it, what the exterior of it is so abnormal that when he slices it in, he basically like takes out one item and then says, all these normal, all these organs are normal. And it's just like, you only have one of them in your hand right now. I don't know if that's a timing issue of when they decided
to. Or three things out. You got like a kidney and then like a heart and then like.
Well, yeah, he went back in digging out more stuff, but he assesses them as normal awfully quick. But they're like, yeah, let's just hang on to this thing because it's fantastic. And they keep trying to radio out for assistance, but the guy who operates the radio, Windows, which is an interesting name, he can't get through to anybody. And he keeps trying to do it, and everybody's really on him now because they have a dead Norwegian guy and some weird thing that they pulled from his camp, and no success contacting McMurdo. And there's nothing else around them. I don't know why they. I can't remember. Was there a line of dialogue about why they didn't like fly to McMurdo or try to fly to another base because the Norwegian base was close, but it didn't seem like they were that close to anything else. But then I don't think there was any line of dialogue that established that.
Maybe no, I don't think there was a dialogue. I think maybe it's either too far away or they had just it hasn't yet got to the severity requiring them to leave and go that far away. They haven't yet freaked out enough to like want to just completely abandon where they're hanging out.
Yeah,
and by the time they do, the helicopter is taken apart.
Yeah. So. Now that they have the weird thing that they brought back from the other base, and they have the dog inside of the kennel with the other dogs, the little dog friend that they picked up at the beginning of the movie starts to behave a little peculiarly. And
by peculiar, you mean its face opens and skull falls out?
Yeah, it's a real icebreaker when you're trying to meet new people. Especially, you know, when a dog tries to meet another dog, sometimes those dogs like to, you know, sniff and, you know, lick and stuff and bark and just be friendly with one another. And other dogs like to split open their faces and drop a skull. And so this one hews more towards the latter, and, it just starts like spraying out little tentacle things and the fur peels back, and it is a horror show in and of itself, and the other dogs are totally freaked out, and one of the dogs gets hosed down with some sort of water that is sprayed. It looks like water, but later on we come to find it as some sort of digestive fluid, much in the same way that certain creatures externally digest other creatures by hosing them down with stomach acid and then consuming them.
Isn't that how flies eat?
Yeah, remember the Jeff Goldblum remake of The Fly? We should do mm-hmm. that next year. For
I'm gonna do that one. That one was gross.
It's super gross. I can't watch it. I have to close my eyes for parts of that. It is one of those movies where it tries to gross you out more than anything else. It doesn't seem to really be interested in you watching the film as much as trying to make you not watch the film. But the effects in here aren't quite on that level. They are grotesque and weird, but they're usually weird in sort of a jarring, like, I can't believe that things split open kind of a way. Because it is completely anatomically abnormal, and doesn't obey, like, the laws of thermodynamics or anything, because, like, it's just making new bone and flesh and whatever at rapid pace. And
a lot of spider leg things.
Yeah, that seems to be a common theme for it. I wonder if that was a fond creature from some other previous encounter on another planet, because it's not very Earth-like when it does that. Because it's not like it was
flailing spaghetti things too.
Yeah, those are cute, especially when it comes right out of the fur of the dog, because it's just like, oh, you really want to go pet it. So. That dog creature has totally gone to pieces and sprayed down the dog. And there's all the other dogs are barking like crazy. And this brings Clark back in, and he goes to check on what's happened inside of the kennel. The light is out, and he can't see inside. It seems suspiciously dark for how well the hallway he's in is lit. It's like the ambient light is just sucked out completely. And so he goes
to
open...
The dogs like to sleep in the dark.
Yes. They got blackout curtains. So he goes to open the kennel grate, and he takes a look inside and sees the partially digested stuff and the other dogs freaking out and the initial look at the hand puppet creature. The hand puppet creature was one of the few things that was farmed out to Stan Winston because Rob Bottin, I think, who did all of the other creature effects, was so overwhelmed working on this movie that it would be best if it was passed off to somebody else. And so Stan Winston and his team went in and they designed a hand puppet operated thing. So the reason why there's a lopsided hump is because there's basically someone's head and shoulder kind of underneath that hump part. And then the arm is operating the mouth of the sort of dog like beak thing that's out of it. And that's how they went with doing that part of it. And when the guys all come over and they come a rushing, for some reason Kurt Russell's like, get the flamethrower.
I think that's the solution to a lot of great problems in the Arctic. Just set it on fire.
Well, this is the solution to like pretty much everything. I mean, aliens, the movie Aliens, Alien, like everything. You just get a flamethrower. And
maybe their base was powered by a nuclear reactor and they didn't want to accidentally pierce it with their shotgun, so they had to burn it.
No, it seemed like it was powered by some weird sort of weird subterranean generator, but we'll get to that later.
Little Honda putt-putt generator or something.
Yeah, so they all are suitably grossed out by this, and with only a moment's hesitation over this, they hose it down with fire. Because the thing grows arms that it reaches up to the ceiling with and pulls its body up off the floor to try to back itself up into the ceiling. It is an interesting look. They burn it, and it is shrieking and screaming and gross. And then when they're done with that business, they're like, maybe there was a problem at the Norwegian base that has something to do with this dog and something to do with that thing we brought back. So let's all, put in place some like safety measures and, let's isolate these things, and we'll cover up that body in the storage room. Doesn't really seem like they did that in a fast pace. But they're just like, yeah, whatever. I'm just going to drag this in to this room and put a wool blanket on top of it. It'll be fine.
And this is right around the time that Wilford Brimley starts doing his computer simulations and calculations, right?
Oh, God, it's so bad. I don't know what it is about the 80s and the 90s where they're like, give me a lab scene. But here it is in this movie. And while I really like this movie a lot, I don't love this scene. It is pretty preposterous because it takes you out of the believability of what you're watching. Even the far-fetched stuff that occurs inside of the film is far-fetched because it came from another world. This particular thing is not far-fetched because it's a computer in the 80s. And it's a computer in the 80s that has some sort of 8-bit animation program for showing cellular takeover by intruder cells on normal dog cells and watching that slowly take place over time.
They took the flying toaster screensaver and they replaced it with cells, and then they just watched it for a little while.
No, After Dark wasn't out yet. But the really weird thing is that after they show that, he does his calculation. He basically types into the computer, like in the first Alien movie, like, what are the chances of this, or like if you were asking Siri or something like that, Siri couldn't answer this question. But he's
hey,
like,
Siri, what percentage of people are potentially infected? Oh God!
Did you drop your phone?
No, I said the words. All right, I said the words and I tried to answer the question. We'll have to. That's why people don't say those words on the podcasts.
No, no, no. Ahoy telephone, Dan.
Mm-hmm. Ahoy telephone. It said probably two of your people are infected. And then, in the Norwegian base, or no, what did it say? Something like
75%.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting number given the crew that they have available to them. But he's pretty haunted by this. And he asks, like, what were the chances if it gets out to, the normal population? Again, not a normal query I would ask of a computer in 1982, but
yeah,
he does.
Say like 20, was it 27,000 days or hours before it spreads all over the world?
What floppy disk was this program running off of?
did you like the treatment of the computer in the opening there, where Russell loses it computer chest and pours his beer into the computer because he's mad at it?
Yeah, that's a very Dark Star moment. It is pretty silly, and it's not only silly because it's hard to believe that somebody would do that, but it's also pretty silly because it's a chess computer with a voice that's Adrienne Barbeau, who was married to John Carpenter at the time, and she's the only female actress in the film. There are women who are in the Let's Make a Deal game show clip that they play, but that's it. There are no other women inside of the whole film, and that was a conscious choice on John Carpenter's part, where he wanted to see what would happen in a group that was an all-male dynamic with the thing on the prowl. So if you're wondering
because
if this
they
movie
would be meaner to each other or something,
yeah, like I don't know, maybe he was worried about, like, if you had to set like a woman on fire and stuff, the connotations of that sort of violence. But then you could have easily made your main character a woman, and then she would have survived until that last part.
Or would she?
So if you're wondering if this movie fails the Bechdel test, yes. And so this what was I saying? Wilford Brimley is all spooked out by this stuff. And they decide
he's got his vodka and he's got his gun. He's going to go protect himself.
Well, after he wrecks the helicopter, and nobody's seen him, but
lock him in there after he starts going haywire and hitting everything, hitting all the computers and stuff with an axe.
Well, but before he does that, we have a different scene where they're putting the body in the storage locker, and the other guy's like, "Yeah, I'm gonna go outside for reasons, and then I'll come back in later." And then he comes back in, and the first guy is covered in slime and tentacles from the corpse that they thought was dead, but it is not. And the guy is freaked out and runs out. Was it Fuchs who sees this and runs away? And he's like, this is scary. And they have
everybody. The lesson we learned from Predator is if it bleeds, you can kill it. But this doesn't bleed. It just oozes pink goop. So you can't kill it.
It's seemingly contagious in some sort of a way where that pink goop could take you over, essentially, because it is full of the creature's cells and the cells themselves.
One cell gets on you, yeah. It could replicate.
Yeah, and so the sees that, runs out, tries to get everybody to come back. They come back inside, and the guy's body's gone. And they're like, well, what happened to him? And they start to try to round up everybody to go find him, and outside in the snow they see him running out of the camp, and they go chase up on him, and they're like, "Hey, what's wrong with you? Like, why aren't you like talking and stuff?" And then you see him hold up the hands and open up his mouth and let out the little scream because it wasn't fully formed yet into him, and so they're like, "Oh, that's bad," and they set him on fire.
With very little hesitation, as soon as they're like, "Oh, this is not a person, this is an alien," let's just dump some kerosene on him and set him on fire.
Yeah, because the thing is that they don't know at the start of this film what has set off the Norwegian people who come into the camp. They don't know later on, like, the thing that they found can actually take on human form. Like, this is the first clue that whatever it is can become a person enough to fool you at least from a distance. And Kurt Russell assesses that that means that because it didn't have much time, that if it had more time, it could have perfectly imitated the other person. But, you know, that's a bit of a stretch. He's kind of making some assumptions there. It turns out to be true, of course, but he didn't really have much else other than that to go off of. That could have been technically the most that it could have turned into a person, and you wouldn't necessarily have known that. But this isn't a movie for science, and they are freaked out by that and go back inside, and they start trying to figure out if there's some way to figure out who among them is a person and who is not. And the blood is all gone. And that was going to be their test, was that they were going to use blood from their stores and mix it with the alien blood, mix it with blood that they would draw from each person. And if it reacted, trying to take over the other blood, then they would assume that that person had been taken over.
And turns out, you know, the sabotage is a big sticking point because nobody knows who it could be. Like, well, you had access, or you had access and you had the keys, but you could have taken it, and don't lie to me or whatever. But all they really needed to do was heat up a copper wire and poke the blood after a while.
Yeah, well, it took them a while to figure that one out. It was a good plan, though, eventually.
It's a survival mechanism of the blood, apparently. It doesn't like to be poked with a warm copper wire.
Yeah. It has some cool freak-out effects when it does that. But so the blood plan...
It's like those fireworks, you know, the little black things that you set on fire and they grow. What do you call those?
The snakes? Is that what that's called?
Yeah, like a little snake.
Yeah. So they're like, yeah, so that plan didn't work. And they all just start shouting at each other and not trusting one another. And Wilford Brimley is locked up in the shack. And he's not well. And they can't quite figure out how they're going to be able to tell each other apart, and like if the creature is alone with anybody, it could take them over, and they don't know how many, what percentage of the people there are real people.
I kind of liked when they revisit Wilford Brimley locked in his little cage there. He's like eating like Chef Boyardee out of a can, but he like fashioned a noose that's just hanging next to him.
Yeah,
just in case, maybe.
It was pretty dark, and he's like, "I'm better now. You can let me out."
I feel a lot better now. I've had some raviolios or whatever, and I have this noose here, and I didn't need to use it, so I'm good.
Yeah, I've had a chance to think about it. It was pretty interesting to see Wilford Brimley in this particular role. He does a good job as this sort of like rattled scientist, and you know, MacReady takes charge and orders Fuchs to continue with what Blair was doing before he went off into, you know, unfortunate pursuits. And
Fuchs is too far gone now, so we're gonna read his research, and then we're gonna pick it up for ourselves.
Yeah, and Fuchs disappears, and nobody can figure out what happened. There is the tattered remains of MacReady's one of MacReady's uniforms, and it's because they had been talking. Well, Kurt Russell had been talking to the tape recorder about how he assumed that the tattered remains of cloth they keep finding are from the creature taking over somebody and then discarding the cloth, and that the one piece that they had found before, they couldn't find the name tag, so they weren't sure who it was among them. That particular shot is framed in such a way that you're looking at Kurt Russell in the extreme foreground, but also out into the hallway. And then there's a shot from the hallway looking in on Kurt Russell. So technically, whoever was impersonating a person could have been in that hallway is the way that shot is framed. That's what it's implying to me, that the creature knows that the clothes are giving him away, and it knows that MacReady's onto him. And so that's why it frames MacReady with the tattered shirt that specifically says his name. And at least that's my assumption that I make from how they chose to frame that, because otherwise it's just really weird framing. And there's
some really good cinematography in this movie, too. We haven't really mentioned that, but it doesn't say on IMDb, but at least a great portion of this is anamorphic, and I think used to actual, like, both technical and artistic usage, because they're in very confined spaces, and they make use of the extra wide stretchiness of the anamorphic frame to sort of get in and out of doorways and door frames and stuff. And of course, all of the, you know, the lens flares from actual flares out in the snow looks super awesome.
Yeah, and this is Dean Cundey, who is a very famous and lauded cinematographer these days, but he hadn't done that many pictures at this point in his career, and he'd mostly been working with John Carpenter. You just go through the list of things that he's been on, and you're just like, oh, wow, that's a lot of good stuff you've worked on, like Apollo 13, Jurassic Park.
Casper, The Flintstones, Hook.
Death Becomes Her.
Roadhouse.
Back to the Future, Part 2, Back to the Future, Part 3. Big Trouble in Little China, your favorite.
I haven't seen that movie in a long time.
Halloween 3, Season of the Witch. That movie's not good. You know, Jack and Jill.
Oh my God, I just saw Jack and Jill.
But no, I mean, Garfield. But he's done The Holiday. He's done some really good stuff. And I don't want to make fun, because I think that he actually is a very good cinematographer. And
Flubber. No, hey, yeah, the, hey, the cinematography of this movie is great.
You like Who Framed Roger Rabbit? Like, he can also do the technical stuff very well. And one thing though about Dean Cundey is a previous VFX supervisor I had worked with. It was kind of on the old school side. By worked with, I mean he used to just talk in dailies. And one time he was telling a story about, you know, Dean Cundey blue, because he was complaining about the blue of nighttime. He's like, night's not blue, like moonlight's not blue, but you know, it's blue because, you know, that's the way that Dean Cundey chooses to light his nighttime scenes, is with very strong, very blue light on stuff to signify that it is the evening or the nighttime. And whereas, you know, it would really just be dark, and that moonlight is actually, you know, just reflected sunlight. So it's not blue, but
sunlight could be,
it's not blue.
I mean, it could be blue if you're white balanced for indoors.
Okay. Touche. But the color temperature of it is not what you see, where it's a cerulean blue washing
it is not,
the
it
landscape.
It's not cerulean night.
Yeah. So that is what, at least what I've heard that VFX supervisor referred to as Dean Cundey blue. Always makes me laugh a little bit. And that is certainly on display here, but Cundey's also very good at framing, for leading the eye to the pieces of information that he wants you to see inside of each of these shots. Notably, when they're examining what's his name? I keep forgetting their names, because they're all like generic white guys mostly.
there was a lot of mixing up of names in my head too.
Yeah, when they're examining Norris, played by Charles Hallahan, there is a shot of Clark going for a scalpel off of a tray to take as a weapon because Kurt Russell's threatening all of them. And so the framing of the shot to let you know that he has a scalpel in his hand is that it's his hand basically taking up the entire screen right side of frame, Kurt Russell in the middle of the frame, and then several of the other actors on the other side over towards the body. And so with the wide anamorphic framing of that, it's really interesting, because you just see the blade, you know, moving around just slightly in his hand. Like, it's just artfully done. I really do appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were a couple instances where when they were pushing through doors kind of slowly, and you know, you could see a couple of
cameraman shadows
in there, but that's, you know, yeah. What are you gonna do other than like paint it out? And we could do that now, but I'm looking at these shots, I'm like, what, to get that wide, and it's a little lens distorted, but like, how would you even shoot this and make it look like that? I'm like, there's no way they're shooting this whole movie with like a 4mm lens. I'm like, is this 70mm? Like, no, they did 70mm prints. I'm like, oh, I guess they just did some anamorphic, because a lot of the interiors are not anamorphic. So they kind of mixed and matched here and there.
It's really well shot. And
was there a split diopter in that one scene where what's his name was looking at the thing, and then over his shoulder, Kurt Russell was in the doorway?
Yeah, Kurt Russell was in the doorway. It was completely dark in the center of frame, and there's a pool of light around Fuchs up in the foreground. And it's when he goes in to check on his progress on working on Wilford Brimley's work. And he does the weird thing of like his hands underneath the desk, and then he pulls his hands out and he doesn't respond at first. And then he says, oh, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, chit chats. But yeah, it's a split diopter for that one.
It's good. It was a good shot. I like all this stuff. It works both artistically and technically for this indoor stuff, because it's all very claustrophobic. And a lot of low angle stuff too, but the only way you can actually see any of the things that are going on is just, you know, the way they've strategically done the anamorphic stuff. Anyway, anamorphic flares in the snow, very pretty.
Yeah, but that comes much later. First, they don't trust each other. And
put you guys over there and tie your hands and get out of the way. And how do I know? I don't know if you're one of the things or if you're a human.
Yeah.
Actually, doesn't he only say the thing one time?
I think he says one of those things too. Because as we know, there wind up being several of the incarnations of the takeover of this initial thing onto different people. Most notably from the start of the film, you have what was brought back from the Norwegian base in that storage room, and then also the dog. So they were already two things at the start of this film from beforehand. And so they don't trust MacReady because of the torn cloth that Niles finds when they are up in the shack, which they went to go check on because their light was up there and he didn't leave it on. Spooky. And he bails on him, cuts the line, goes inside, and they're like, well, you know, there's no way he could be coming back, you know, without the line. That can't be him outside. He's got to be one of those things. You know, if you were one of those things, how would you even know, et cetera, et cetera. And they
underestimated Kurt Russell, though, because Kurt Russell's tough. He's got a flamethrower.
Yeah, he breaks into the storage room. And then he finds the cartoon dynamite, and he takes the cartoon dynamite. And I have to think that by 1982, no one was putting dynamite in sticks like that, because that just doesn't seem like it was appropriate for the era. But I think, like, it has to be something where they were just like, yeah, this is movie shorthand, because it'll let the audience know very quickly that this is dynamite. That's my assumption, because, you know, just looking at it, I'm just like, why am I looking at, like, Looney Tunes dynamite? But they,
Don't they use stuff like that for mining and things and blowing holes in the hill?
But I don't think they put it in sticks anymore. But, so, anyway, they have a storehouse full of dynamite and stuff. And he takes a flare and, you know, he's gonna light it and he's gonna blow everybody up. And, you know, you guys better back off and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, this is when Norris, who had briefly coughed and, you know, grabbed his chest when he was looking out a window earlier, like, rushes towards Russell and gets knocked into the side of the one of the shelving units, and he's out of it. And it seems suspicious because he wasn't really, like, knocked that hard. And so they take him to go get it examined by Dr. Copper, and they're, you know, he's not breathing. He tries to administer CPR. He asks for the paddles. He's going to, you know, electrically stimulate him with the paddles. But before he can do that, the chest splits open on Norris and reveals a gaping maw, which consumes the doctor's arms at the forearms and splits them with a mouth-closing motion that causes blood and bone to fall out, and just it's unpleasant. He falls over backwards, not feeling well.
I didn't see that clip before, but that it's kind of it's almost hilarious. The way it splits open and turns into like Tremors teeth or something, and then just bites his arms off.
It is really interesting to think about the design of each of these effects, because they're basically done to look right from the camera's point of view, but they usually have somebody underneath the table or underneath the floor. In the case of the rib cage, there's a hydraulic stuff that moves it. And in order to do that arm splitting thing, those arms that they cut through are actually made out of jello and with wax bones and some like rubber veins and jello veins and stuff inside. And so
you're giving away all the Hollywood magic secrets.
It's not Hollywood magic secrets when you watch it. Little clip of somebody explaining how they did it, but
practical effects. It's the real deal.
Yeah, well, and they put the fake arms on top of someone who had an amputation from an industrial accident, so he was hired for the film in order to wear this prosthesis for this shot, and then they also put a prosthesis on his face that was designed to look like the actor who plays Dr. Copper, Richard Dysart, and they only show him in the wide shot when he reels back with the destroyed arms from the creature crunching it. But the creature really did crunch it that fast because it was hydraulic. What was really scary, though, if I was the actor who was doing it, was apparently that was really him who put his arms into the chest with the paddles before they cut to the other angle to show it closing. And I don't know about you, but if someone told me, here, put your arms inside of this hydraulic maw, I don't know. we're gonna film this shot, and then we're going to move on to the other one where it crushes it. So just go ahead and stick your arms in there. I would be like, nope, not doing it, because that is horrifying. Fortunately, nothing bad happened. But they did have some other severe technical malfunctions with this, especially the scene. Norris, Charles O'Hallahan, who plays Norris, is underneath the table with just his arms and his head, and the whole torso area is a specifically designed prosthetic for this one shot, and it's blended in at the neck, and like they even, you know, replicated the hairs and stuff and made him look as real as they possibly could, and that is the thing that splits open to reveal that gaping maw. So he's still inside of that when they're doing the whole thing, and apparently one of the times it split open, it was also after it splits open, does the chomp thing, then it splits open again and does the spraying goo stuff. Apparently John Carpenter didn't like the first take of that and wanted to do it again, but Rob had designed these as sort of like a one shot kind of a deal things, because you have to physically break stuff when this happens and spray things. And so it took another like 10 hours to reset that shot back up and do it again.
Did he have to just lay there the whole time?
Yeah. He had to lay there in the harness the entire time for both the initial setup and for the second setup in the same day, because they had to get it done that day. Now, it wasn't helped by the other subsequent shot of when the neck separation occurs. It's a very famous scene. There's a clip of it that's inside of Stranger Things, which I know you've seen, when the teacher has his date over and he's trying to impress her with the VHS of the thing that he had rented. And he starts explaining all the, you know, bubblegum and melted plastic they put inside of the neck in order to make it stretch and do that stuff. And that is all true, apparently. But Rob had also like put in like paint thinners and all kinds of stuff, and it just had like a really strong chemical smell that was very distracting. But then John Carpenter realized that, oh, there's supposed to be fire from, you know, they've already started spraying the fire in this sequence, so we need to have some fire in the shot in the foreground. So get a fire bar and put it by the camera. And so they light up the fire bar, and that lights fumes from the chemicals coming out of the prosthesis and sets the prosthesis on fire. Everybody who was under the table was fine, but the thing on top was totally burned, and so they had to reset that up and shoot another day.
It's pretty great shot, like, because they torch the thing and then they wait long enough for it to be dead, and then they put it back out with the fire extinguisher so the building doesn't burn down. But then like the head like melts off the side of the table and then sprouts its legs, and he's like hiding under a desk, and then it sneaks around him.
First, it has that tongue shot where it spews out that tongue, which coils around the leg of a chair and starts pulling the head slowly. Mm-hmm. And so you get one of the things that I like about that effect is that you get the weight of the head being dragged. Because a lot of it sort of like stops as it's reeling itself in, essentially. And rests like for a second and then pulls and then rests and pulls and rests. I like that because it makes it feel more alive than what a lot of other people think of when they do this stuff, where they just try to make it go as fast as possible. And so it doesn't, a lot of times when you see things, either CG or practical, it doesn't feel like it has weight, that it feels like it's, you know, some head stuck to the floor dragging itself. And I feel like that is adequately communicated by the shot. You mm-hmm. do see some light poking through the back of the head, though, from the jaw area. But, you know, I guess that was a real hole or whatever. It was an alien. once it pulls itself underneath that desk, then you also get the other famous shot of the spider legs sprouting out of it and the eye stalks sprouting out of it, out of the top, which is, I think, probably one of the more iconic moments from this.
Yes, and quite disturbing. And yeah. Then I particularly love how, like, when it snuck around them and they turn around and see it, like, just walking out the door, and it just kind of looks a little bit lost and wandering, like, well, you know, the rest of my body just kind of like melted off. But they're just like, oh, gross. What the hell is this now? And then just burn it again.
Yeah. And that was something I think Palmer shouted. He's sort of just staring gobsmacked at it because he can't believe it. But as when I was talking about like the weight of the head, I feel like the spider creature does not have weight to it because you can really tell that it's mainly propelled by someone moving the head part and then the little legs dancing around in the air. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel like it's pushing off the ground. There's a nice shot where it leans out from underneath the desk, though, and it does feel like it has weight because they glued the little feet of the spider legs to the ground and then just basically moved the head out by operating it with a hand from underneath the desk. And so that way you
Pretty
can... smart. Yeah, so that way you get sort of like... If you're familiar with computer animation, it'd be what they call IK, inverse kinematics. And so when you have somebody who's walking, they have to basically stick their foot to something and it can't move. But then you have to calculate the movement based on where you're moving the joint. So like if you're moving the waist, where do you calculate where the leg bends? And so that's sort of the same thing where it's like you're moving the head around and the bottom of the foot is glued to the ground, but the joints are still moving. So they follow the movement of the head, and it looks like the head is being moved by the legs pushing up off the ground. But like I said, the one where it's crawling away, less effective because it's just pitter-patter through the air.
But the visual effects are better. There's just you click the make spider walk button and then it walks properly.
No, you say that, but I'm actually kind of interested to someday watch the 2011 prequel.
Is that what it's supposed to be, the prequel?
Yeah, it's supposed to be a prequel. I don't know how prequely it is, but...
Is this supposed to be the Norwegian base?
It's my assumption. I've never actually read... I just heard it was called the prequel. I don't have a tremendous amount of faith that I will like it, but supposedly it's also... it uses the old computers, and as we know, those are cursed and evil. You should never use computers. But we'll find out. But they set that little head thing on fire, and they're like, "Well, screw this. We got to find some sort of way in order to tell everybody apart. There just has to be some method we could devise." And so they come up with the heated piece of wire, and there's a very slow scene because this would take time, where they all tie each other up, and Keith David is very upset about that. I love watching movies with Keith David in it because he's so very rarely in front of the camera, but he's a very familiar voice if you've heard any of his many, many voice actor parts, either for film or TV or video games. But anyway, so Keith David,
he's good. He's really young in this movie too, so he doesn't even have his like his signature angry scowl face down quite yet.
No, and he's grumpy, he's a hothead, and so that's why they don't get along apparently. So they go through this long protracted scene of everybody's tied up except for Knowles, who's collecting the blood into the little petri dishes, and then MacReady is burning the little wire underneath the flamethrower in order to test.
I like how Windows, by the way, like when he does his own, he just like wipes the scalpel off on his pant leg, like, yeah, that's not going to contaminate anything.
Yeah. And so
also
they...
Also, cutting yourself on the edge of the thumb, oof, that sounds painful.
Yeah. Like, there's... I forget who it was, but one of them basically, like, the cut starts, like, almost at the tip of the thumbnail. And I was just like, oh, God, gross. But they put some blood into the little petri dishes and they start testing and they start eliminating who isn't an alien. And they strongly suspect Gary. And so, Kurt Russell's like, Gary, I'm going to save you for last. Because they don't get along. And, he finally goes to test Palmer, and unfortunately Palmer's is the one that explodes in his hand and sends blood onto the floor, which runs around, which isn't really running. They move the surface and then the blood slid off of it. It's really not really that complicated, but that's how they did it. But then
it's another T-1000 moment, but not with metal dots with blood.
Yeah, but there's a cool shot of Palmer's face exploding into a creature. Unfortunately, there wasn't enough of an intermediary phase. They kind of go from it looks like polymer to it looks like a rubber mask that looks like polymer awfully quick.
Yeah. Although I do particularly love that, like, he kind of had a plan going through this, heating up the metal wire and putting it into stuff. I probably wouldn't have had it in my hand because, you know, the reaction was a little bigger than he probably anticipated.
Oh, yeah.
But I love that when it starts, like, not even because his blowtorch starts malfunctioning or whatever, but, like, they're all tied together on the same bench and everyone's, like, trying to get away. And they're like, nope, you're still tied to this thing as it grows and turns into a giant alien.
Yeah. And so they finally get him off of there. It sprouts like a Venus flytrap, kind of a head mouth, and chomps on Windows. Like that head bites Windows' head, and starts lifting him up into the air and all kinds of wacky stuff. And there's some jumping on the ceiling stuff and things. There's a lot of chaos and shouting and stuff. And Kurt Russell, unfortunately, is having trouble with his flamethrower and cannot spray it with the normal fire stuff that would normally, up to this point in the film, solve some problems. They eventually get that sorted, hose him down with the fire stuff. It wanders through the room on fire, meaning a stunt guy is wandering on fire through the room, right past... hangs a right turn at Kurt Russell and goes straight through the wall and out into the snow and then dies. And
it's trying to put itself out and Kurt Russell tosses a cartoon stick of dynamite at it.
Yeah, and it explodes rather spectacularly. And then he unfortunately has to kill Windows because Windows was bit by the creature and covered in goo from the creature. So that's only a matter of time before he turns into... a more menacing character. So they just kill him.
Before he turns into Windows 95.
Oh. Woof.
Sorry, I guess it would be Windows Vista. That's his final state.
I thought we were up to Windows 10 now.
Well, no, his final horrifying form would be Vista. Because that was the scariest of them.
10 is pretty terrifying. You ever tried to set up Wi-Fi on a relative's... Windows computer that they can't figure out how to work.
I played with it for a little while, but
oh god, it's so confusing. It's like, okay, so you got a system tray and it has a Wi-Fi thingy in it, and there's a Wi-Fi thingy from the company that made the driver for the laptop for that company, and it's also there in the tray, and then it's also got something inside of the system preferences for the Wi-Fi, and none of those things seem to be controlling it. Oh, what's that? There's a Wi-Fi charm. Tell me more about charms. And then sure enough, that's where it was. Anyway, so Wi-Fi on Windows, terrible. I'm sure had Windows lived long enough, he would have figured out Wi-Fi. And that would have helped him with all of his radio problems. But
we should have just set Windows on fire back in the 80s.
Well, maybe that's why Windows couldn't reach anybody on the radio. He didn't have his Wi-Fi set up properly. So they're like, okay, so we basically have figured out most of these people. So let's go right back to this test because we still got Gary and God, what's his name?
Knowles and Childs are both still tied.
Childs, yeah. And so they test them and just like, okay, so everyone's fine. We're all fine here. We're all good. And they had tested the body of Clark, who unfortunately, Kurt Russell had shot right in the head because he was moving at him with that scalpel from earlier. Yeah. So
Kurt Russell is suffering no fools, alien or not, in this movie. He's just like, you know what? I'm in charge here. I don't care what you say. Come at me. I'll shoot you.
Yeah. Kurt Russell is protecting himself rather, handily, but, unfortunately, he unfortunately comes with this ridiculous plan at this point in the film where they're going to go check on Blair and do the blood test. But this plan involves them leaving one of them inside of the base, and they decide that it will be Childs. And as we've learned up to this point in the film, do not leave people out of your sight, because that is when the bad things happen. Especially do not leave one person out of your sight, because bad things happen. And they keep making the same mistake, and they will go on to make this same mistake again later. But so they leave Childs there. They go towards the shed. The shed door is open. They're all freaked out by it because where did he go? And they look underneath the floorboards. They go down into a little ice cave that appears to be very quickly dug up. And there are parts of something that looks like a very small flying saucer, very similar to what we saw at the beginning of the film, that are being built. And so they toss some dynamite down there, blow that up. And they're like, okay, great. Mission accomplished. Let's go back inside now. Unfortunately, they see a shadowy figure run out of the building, and then the lights go out, and then the emergency lights come on, and that's it. And it's like, okay, so cut the power to the generator. We're all completely screwed, and we're all going to die, because without the generator, everybody's going to freeze to death. And I forget who points it out, but they're like, yeah, so if we freeze all of us, then won't the creature also be dead? Like, well, it'll be frozen too. And they're like, well, it survived being frozen once, so it's just gonna go back to being frozen because that's its best odds, because it won't be killed by one of us. And then when a rescue party comes, then it can go amongst them and get out of here. And so they're like, oh, well, that's not good. And it's like, yes, no, that's not good. So our mission now is that even though we're gonna die, we need to make sure we take this thing down with us. And so they go back into the base, patrol through it. They can't find Childs. They decide to go down to the generator room after torching things and blowing things up. And they're going to set the remaining sticks of dynamite through the generator room in order to blow it up. And that should also blow up the base above because it's underneath it. Unfortunately, this is another scene where Kurt Russell's like, okay, you go over there and you go over there, and I'm just going to stay here and set up this plunger thing. And it's another instance of there is no immediate need for them to rush to do this and split up the party like this. Like, they could have all walked together to set up the dynamite. But for some reason, they're like, no, let's all do this individually because nothing could go wrong. So I have to say...
Well, with the speed with which he built a flying saucer under the snow, maybe he needs to move a little bit quicker than that, which, that was probably the only part that I thought was a little peculiar. And, they're rushing against the time because he said, a couple hours, it's going to be minus 100 degrees and we're all going to die. So, that's when they try to get the generator back on, and then they realize it was taken by the alien. So it's like, well, we're all just going to die from freezing to death, so we better make sure we take this thing out with us now.
Yeah, but unfortunately, there's really no reason they need to split up for that. They're all inside the same ice cave about 30 feet apart from one another. They could have all just walked together to lay these things, but they didn't. And Gary goes to walk down the old storage room full of frozen junk. And there's a flickering orange light, which seems to be emitting from no particular source. This is what you would not call sourcey lighting, because it's like, what is that? Is it supposed to be fire? And so there's a flickering orange light. And so... Gary gets to the end of the thing, hangs a Louis, and there's Wilford Brimley there. Surprise! And he puts his hand not just over his mouth, but through his cheeks, and sort of like fuses into him as he muffles him.
Kind of like the alien robots in The World's End.
Yeah. So not a great thing for Wilford Brimley to do to Gary. I'm sure Gary didn't appreciate it very much, but Gary's out of the picture. And then Knowles goes to check on Gary again by himself because, hey, somebody suspiciously hasn't come back from this room yet. Maybe I'll go down there by myself and go check. And totally without Kurt Russell, who has another flamethrower. But anyway, so Knowles disappears off screen and we don't hear anything. Kurt Russell calls for him and nobody's coming. So he's like, okay, this is spooky. And he walks down there very slowly, gets to the end, and then all of a sudden, stuff underneath the floorboards. And this is where they dragged something underneath the floor and broke it all up. And then a stop-motion creature springs up and destroys the plunger. And supposedly, there was a whole stop-motion creature sequence of it that was not used. It was on the cutting room floor because Carpenter felt it looked too much like stop motion to his eye, so he didn't want to see it in the film. He just wanted to have the creature effects. So it's gone, but
it's fine.
Yeah. I mean, you know, stop motion looks like stop motion. What are you going to do? But the problem with the creature effects here is that it's mostly static, because I believe it was mainly designed around the idea being that it would be mostly motivated by the movement of the other stop motion thing and the wide shots, because all we get are these sort of like close-ups of this spinning totem mostly. It's not as impressive as some of the earlier creatures to me. It's much bigger, but it doesn't seem to have all of the movement and morphing qualities that
it's big and gross and terrifying, and it's got a dog head and some human bits, and it's all the pieces together.
Yeah, it's you know, it's just like a Kurt Russell, This Is Your Life. I'm gonna show you all your favorite moments from this film. And so the little fashion plate of a creature is accosting Kurt Russell, who is like, well, screw you, and I'm gonna set this last stick of dynamite I'm holding on fire and throw it at you, because the creature has destroyed the plunger. This blows up the creature, blows it up good, and Kurt Russell manages to survive the explosion and get out of there. He crawls back up to the top, and he's inside of the ruins of the facility, and breathing softly to himself as Keith David wanders over, and he's like, oh yeah, I just wandered out there because I thought I saw, you know, Wolf of Brimley in the snow. And he's like, yeah, sure.
Got lost while I was out there, sure.
Yeah, and well, neither one of us is in any kind of shape to do anything. And I guess we're just to wait and see what happens. And then the score kicks up. And we pull out to a wide shot of the base burning slowly, and we get the credits.
Yeah, the fire is keeping them warm for now, but not for long. So let's have a drink and hang out here for a bit.
Yep.
So how do you think it ended? What do you think happened? Do you think Childs is infected?
Okay, so I cheated and I used Google. And
what?
Yeah, I know, it's hard to believe.
Is there actual defined stuff about what happened?
According to Dean Cundey, they had tried to figure out if there was something they were going to do in terms of lighting to indicate who had and who had not been infected to the
through the whole movie or in this last scene.
Through parts of the film. And so what they wound up settling on when they were doing the blood scene earlier is that the little kicker lights that they would put in for the eyes, that they would leave them off for whoever was the creature. So it didn't have that little highlight in the eye whenever it was the creature, only when you were a normal human. It was
kind of the opposite of how the poster looks, where there's a giant bright white light coming out of the face of a shadowy figure, but whatever, that's fine.
Well, we never saw that in the film at all, Dan.
Yeah, I know.
thank you, Drew Struzan, for setting unreasonable expectations for Dan. But I like Drew Struzan's work, but
the poster looks like Swamp Thing or something.
I like the poster.
No, it's cool. It just doesn't fit the movie.
Oh no, it doesn't fit the movie at all. But it's neat and ominous. But and it gets butts in the seats, Dan. That's what they want in Hollywood. So anyway,
did it really get butts in the seats with $15 million?
I think it opened like number 8 or something. And
it reminds me of wasn't there a Scooby-Doo bad guy that was like a skull that was glowing?
I mean, I think there were several. But going back to the thing that I was talking about, apparently it was about the highlights, and that Childs doesn't have that little kicker light for the highlight in his eye at the end of the movie, and so Cundey had kind of spilled the beans. And Carpenter's intention is, of course, for this to be ambiguous completely. So I don't think Cundey was supposed to say anything, but there you have it.
Hmm. Well, I would have expected, you know, Kurt Russell said, you know, neither of us are in any shape to do anything. And it's probably just like, you know, it felt like he was playing up like, well, I sure am tired after trying to blow up the big alien monster there. And I'm just going to rest right here because you have a flamethrower that's basically pointed at me. But he knows he's going to die because the whole base is shredded and like they're going to freeze to death. And he knows that the alien can survive the freeze. So I would have figured he would have just like lied or found some way to just actually kill Childs because there was some uncertainty there, I figured he would have just done something to like, oh, look, I have a handgun. I'm going to shoot you in the face now.
He could have done that off screen at the end of the film because it was an ambiguous ending. We don't know what happens.
Well, you know, the ambiguous ending sort of is just like, well, they're going to die from freezing. Like, if neither of them are infected, then it's fine. They did their job. If one of them is infected, then it's going to spread. But like, I just don't, I felt like MacReady had a few more tricks up his sleeve before he gave up.
Well, he was next to a stick of dynamite that had exploded. So he was tuckered out.
Mm-hmm. But tuckered out. He's just going to put his face up against the wall and finish off that last little bit of whiskey that he had.
J&B, gross. So
sounds pretty good if you're in the middle of the snow being attacked by aliens.
Everything's relative. But but you know, he could have just said, yeah, we'll just wait and see what happens, and maybe something happened, and maybe he killed him, maybe nothing happened, maybe it was, had nothing to do with those little highlights. Maybe that's the real trick. That's the double turns out, is that it had nothing to do with it. You know,
the highlights were in our eyes all along.
Mm-hmm. So the highlights of this movie for me are the creature effects, of course, regular schmoes on a base doing stuff is always a delight. Very, very similar to Alien or some of the other things like Dark Star, etc. I don't really like Dark Star that much, to be perfectly honest. I would not recommend paying any money to go watch Dark Star. But it is sort of like, if you watch that and have seen a lot of Carpenter's stuff that came later, and also Dan O'Bannon's writing that came later, you're like, oh, that kind of makes more sense now why you're that way. Those parts of the thing I like a lot, and I feel like it is very technically well executed in spite of the lab scene that I don't like very much. I think is pretty good. I do have some questions about exactly when Wilford Brimley was taken over, because that wasn't super clear to me, and I never looked that part up. Do you have any insight on when you think that might have happened during the course of the events in the film?
I would have imagined it would have been when he was putting his hands inside the big mutated thing with the totally normal organs inside.
Yeah, so then do you think he was sabotaging the helicopter because he wanted to make his alien spaceship out of it? Or do you think he didn't know he was the alien at the time and sabotaged it, and then when he was all calm and placid later on, he was at peace with the fact that he was the alien, and that then his plan was to make the spaceship out of the helicopter parts?
Yeah, you know, because generally, like, when the infected folks are, like, trying to do stuff that would otherwise expose them, they sort of react differently to it. So I think when he initially sabotaged the helicopter, he was just in a rush to prevent it from leaving, because he was pretty freaked out by the idea of the spreading. And I think he went from zero to none of us can leave this place alive pretty quickly. And I think he was on a tear for that for a while. And maybe just all of the exercise of swinging that axe really made it metabolize, and then took him over sort of in that scene there, or just when he was locked up. But I think when he did the initial sabotage, he was still mostly human. But then later, when he, you know, starts building his flying saucer, I think that's when he's full alien.
Yeah, because I have a suspicion that when Palmer was infected, that he went out to the shed Wilford Brimley was in and infected Wilford Brimley in the shed.
Oh, that's an interesting theory.
I don't know if that's true or not, but it's a possibility.
Hmm. I mean, because he was wearing gloves doing his autopsy, but there was a lot of sludge all over the place.
He had it all over his upper arms, past, they were like teeny tiny little gloves. I wouldn't wash the dishes with those gloves.
That's why I think he freaked out so quickly and said, like, we gotta trash this whole place because we can't let this out of here, because he knows, like, I touched it and I see from my computer simulation here that it's going to take me over, so we gotta shut this thing down quick.
Yeah, it could be. And I'm not sure exactly when Palmer was taken over. I know at the beginning, there's the scene in the bedroom where we see the shadow and the dog walk into the, you know, the bunk, and someone goes to pet the dog. And I wasn't sure if that was supposed to be Palmer or Clark. Because Clark also says that he was alone with the dog for about an hour to Wilford Brimley later on.
I thought he was just talking about that, like, in the rec room area. But yeah, it's a possibility there, too.
Yeah. Because I think that might have been when Palmer was infected. He was the guy who was in the bunk. And then he could have infected Brimley after that. Or, like you said, it could have been from all of the completely unsanitary autopsy stuff he was doing. When he was like, yep, totally normal organs. Let me crack another crab leg.
Gross. Yeah, it could have been from the dog bits that he touched too, because you know maybe the first alien was still sort of dormant for a while, so that one hadn't reawoken yet, and the dog was pretty fresh, so maybe he got it there. You know, there are a variety of possibilities. I don't necessarily need that answer to see how quickly this could have spread. Like, I mean, somebody could have sneezed on somebody off screen, and that could have done it too.
Yeah, well, that's also why they go to consuming food from canned sources, supposedly, is that it could have been transmitted through their food. In which case, it also brings up the question of, like, if you were that creature, wouldn't you just be trying to get bodily fluids all over everybody as fast as possible? Because, like, if you were that creature and you, let's say, cut a thumb or something and then just, like, went around and hosed everybody with a little blood, they might kill you, but you've contaminated everybody who's there.
Well, I think at least for most of its existence, it's trying not to expose itself so it can spread and move around. And only once it has an escape plan or is fully backed into a corner, then it exposes itself. But in general, it just wants to sort of, like, ride along and then, you know, get out of there.
Yeah, I would say that's probably accurate. Because it does, that's the whole theory behind the second blood test that they come up with, is that the act of self-preservation, even for the individual components that make up the creature, is so strong that it will react to the hot wire.
Yeah, it's all rational, believable thing. Well, not rational, but it's all stuff that I would believe people would do in this situation. And like you said, the characters are all people. They don't all seem like the same voice. It's pretty, they're pretty, you can follow along what they're doing, and you believe what they're doing, and you believe what they say. And the script's pretty solid, cinematography is pretty great, and the alien's kind of creepy and gross.
Yeah. Oh, it's not even one alien. It's a continuously evolving array of different effects that you see through the film. And I think that is partially also why this is looked upon so fondly, because of that effort that was put into different ways of changing and transforming and altering the appearance of the creature. Because if it was like I've seen some other movies where there's a creature that can imitate a human being, and then it turns into just that one creature over and over and over again. And it's like, oh, that's kind of boring. Like, if you could turn into anything, why would you turn into just the same old, like, just turn into some blob of dog heads? Like, they're off. The world is your oyster. The world is your dog head. And the it doesn't always ring true to me, especially if you watch, like, have you seen Species?
Some of it.
Oh, don't watch the rest. But Natasha Henstridge is a person who can transform into this alien creature and then back into Natasha Henstridge. Unfortunately, that's it. And it seems a little weird. It's like, if you hit all this shape-shifting stuff, you could do all kinds of other things. There are other movies where people are impersonated or whatever, and it's like they always turn back into, like, default pose. It's like, I wish that wasn't always the case. Like, you could be a little more varied. Because I think that part of the reason why it's so interesting to watch this film, even when you know what's going to happen, like, I've seen this enough times that where I know when the spider legs come out of the thing, and I know when the head slides off the table, and I know, you know, what to expect when the dog sprouts the arms to go up to the ceiling. Like, all of that stuff, it doesn't necessarily surprise me but I have it has my interest every time I see it on the screen. And that's not something I can say of a lot of puppetry, especially of the 80s, where, you know, you watch that stuff and you're just like, okay, fine, whatever. Like Quado and Total Recall. It's like, ugh, God.
Yeah, this one has you saying, what the hell, in the sense that, like, it's some sort of, it's an alien species and it's just grabbing bits and parts of DNA along the way, trying to learn and mimic itself as it can. And then it's just using those however it sees fit, especially, like, you know, what's his face that ran out in the snow and hadn't fully turned yet. But like it's trying to learn and use all of these pieces together in its ultimate grand strategy. But it doesn't have like a defined being. It's just trying to fit in wherever it goes. It's trying to use its own cloaking mechanism, like the Predator, but more effectively.
I totally got it as soon as you said cloaking mechanism with that inflection.
Well, you know.
But
gotta spell it out for the audience sometimes.
Yeah. Now, what if we had Aliens versus Predator versus the Thing?
Well, obviously all of the aliens and predators would be infected by this.
Yeah. Because they're not exactly like a sanitary, no blood sport kind of opponents.
I mean, the question really is, aside from infecting more people, what is the alien's goal? Like, it doesn't really seem to have a goal other than survival, which is totally a reasonable thing for an alien organism to have as its goal. But it's not like, aha, I'm going to spread into all of the world's leaders and then rule the world and everyone will do my bidding. It's like, it's not trying to accomplish anything other than not die.
I kind of like that we don't know what its ultimate end goal is. Like, if it wasn't in a situation where it was fighting to survive or it was threatened, you know, if it was the thing in the big city, like, what would it necessarily want? Does it just want to consume everyone on a planet? Is that its goal? Or is consuming people a defense mechanism only? And that if it was inside of a larger populace, you know, it might just like eat like a person or two a year, mm-hmm. You know, just enough to sate its appetite. But because we don't see enough of it in a non-threatened environment. It's perfectly adequate for this film to only explore what it's like when it is under this kind of, when it's under these circumstances. So we don't need to know, like, what its hopes and dreams are and, like, that it likes long walks on the beach or anything.
Right, but, like, you know, the questions that we don't need the answers to that we might want the answers to are, like, why did it crash on Earth in the first place? Has it actually been here for 100,000 years, which, you know, that's what they said. Did it come here on purpose? Was it accidental? It seems to adapt pretty well, but is it actually compatible with human hosts, or would it need, like, you know, would they eventually start to disintegrate over time, and would it need to jump from host to host over time, and then, you know, theoretically on an infinite time scale, it would consume everybody or whatever. But like, what is the goal? What does it do? But we don't need that for the purposes of this movie at all.
Yeah, and which I'm also I'm totally fine with what this creature is doing here, because it is in a very confined environment and reacting specifically to the stimuli in front of it. So we don't need to know its backstory or its off-screen Shakespearean asides about like what it hopes to do later on, or like, you know, where it's hoping to go with that ship that it's building underneath the shed.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it refreshing when people make movies and they don't have to go for a franchise from the opening frame? We need to explain all the things about this world and the character's backstory and what it's going to do if we don't achieve our goals.
Well, I mean, I would argue that all of the recent movies we've watched this October, from Aliens to Predator and Predator 2, haven't disclosed what the opponent necessarily hopes to achieve in a final end state.
I don't know. I mean, the aliens want to be, you know, the dominant race on a given planet, you know, just breeding, growing, spreading, eating people. The Predator just likes to hunt and stuff, which is totally all we really need to know about it. But
yeah, but I mean, we don't know anything about, like, the predator's background, like when it leaves the planet. Like it's not necessarily threatened under these same confined circumstances, but we still know almost nothing about it.
Well, we know the rules about its world that overlap in the Venn diagram with human beings, which is that we are lesser beings and it's going to hunt us because it thinks it's fun.
Yeah. And so I guess that is more than we know about the thing, because we don't know maybe it does like to hunt us because it thinks it's fun. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe it's not really a people person, so to speak.
Maybe it's just playing like a really, really, really serious intergalactic game of hide and seek.
Maybe. Now, another interesting connection for the movies that we've discussed this October. You want to guess what it is?
No.
That was fun. Thanks. So the other interesting connection is Stan Winston actually worked on all of them.
Wouldn't Stan Winston not work on a movie that involves practical effects and puppets and stuff?
Yeah, this is a fair point. Although he has a very minor role in just doing that one dog effect.
One way this relates to other movies that we've talked about is this movie was shot on film with cameras and lights. Not sorry.
Thanks, Dan. So the
Stan Winston is basically a camera. He's going to be used.
Okay, I would have used different wording for that. But since it's been a while since I had seen this before I watched it for this podcast, and it's been a while, I assume, since you've seen it, and you may have never seen the entire thing. What do you think about the entire film? Like, does the atmosphere and the suspense of this film work for you, or are you removed from it because it is dated for the era, or because you're watching it for this podcast and thinking about it analytically? Or did you watch it in a bright room with the lights on? Was Amanda like browsing on an iPad or something when you were watching it? Like, tell me your feelings.
I will not go on about all of the ways in which I compromised my viewing experience, of which there are a couple factors that, you know, would make some famous directors cringe a bit. But
did you watch it on your iPhone?
I did not watch it on my iPhone. I may have eaten dinner while I was watching a portion of it. But
was it like a bolognese? did you have something nice, meaty, and chunky? Like, what would you eat?
No, it was pasta, but it was like a potato kind of. Anyway, it was fine. No, it's a weird pasta recipe thing, but it was good anyway. Mm. But I enjoyed the movie. I think this would be definitely one that would be cool to see in a theater. You know, the eeriness of it loses a little bit because, you know, A, I know the story, and B, you know, the creature effects are good, and a lot of them are new to me because I don't think I've seen all of them. They're still very creature effect-y, and, you know, like, going into this, I know I hadn't seen that very last scene, but I know that everyone in the movie has to die. Like, I just know they all have to die. So I kind of felt like I was working towards that from the very beginning, basically because, like, you know, they're all very real characters, and they're following, they're doing what they know they need to do in order to keep this thing from spreading. So it's like, well, yeah, they're all going to die. That's just the natural, they all have to die. So I know what's going to happen in the end, and I'm sure there's going to be some sort of little twist to it at the end there where we don't know if Childs is infected or not, but, like, you know, you're working your way towards something that you already know what it is, which, you know, it doesn't add to suspense, doesn't necessarily take away from it either, but anyway, that's, you know, it was an enjoyable experience. I would like to see this thing in the theater. This thing I can't keep saying thing. But
you're doing it. You're stuck in the thing trap.
All of the various things. I think it's beautifully shot too. So that's another thing that really held my interest. And it's not, the score does a good job of keeping some excitement when necessary. It's not Predator level of in your face, but it's certainly good.
Yeah, one of the things that surprised me is actually the score, because I had forgotten that it was Ennio Morricone, who's famous for many things, but this was
recently
not what
won an Oscar.
I think that's one of those Oscars that they hand out when they're like, yeah, you did some other stuff earlier in your career where we could have given you an award and we didn't, but now we're going to totally give you one for this thing that was pretty good, but not as good as the things that we didn't give you awards for earlier. I think it was one of those Oscars. But
came out of retirement to work with Tarantino, so.
Yeah, well, he did it. He did a, you know, good job with this, even though, you know, it sounds very John Carpenter-y. Like, it's an electronic score with a very, like, thrumming, moody heartbeat quality to it, which, you know, it's not something I necessarily would have associated with a style that I think of as Ennio Morricone, but it was good. It works for the film. And like you said, it doesn't like take over what you're watching.
Yeah. The drummy bassy sort of tune towards the end seemed a little out of character, but it worked for the scene. I think it was just like, oh, is this scored by a different person?
What?
There was a song toward the end there where Kurt Russell is stalking around. I think right roundabouts, when they're playing the dynamite, where it shifts very sort of like, loud drums and minimal everything else, and it seemed different than all of the music that we had heard up until that point in the movie.
I don't know. It could have been a little snippet of something else that they used, but in total, I think it works for the film overall, even though it is subdued and not exactly something I drive around to Los Angeles listening to on a regular basis, like I do with my action scores that I like listening to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's weird.
What, driving around Los Angeles listening to action scores?
A little bit, yeah.
Okay.
Unless it's the Predator 2 score. Because that fits.
Okay. Because we're in the jungle. We got fun and games. Anything you want?
You already did that one.
Yep. Okay, so just making sure. Just want to make sure I grind it into the snow. One thing about the one last thing before I forget. When we talked about the ship and Wolf Whitlock's matte painting and also the block of ice that had been cut out and taken back to the base, one thing I didn't mention earlier was that they had appraised that the saucer buried underneath the ice was there for probably about 100,000 years, given the level of ice that it was under. But the little hole that they cut for removing the creature was significantly closer towards the surface.
Mm-hmm.
So how did it not, why is it not down there? Why is it up there?
Well, it was, I like how they said it was either thrown from the site or crawled from the site. Well, I don't think it was thrown from the site. Like, it doesn't have a windshield that it went through and then landed. So I guess it crashed and was, it either got out and was like, oh crap, I forgot my winter coat, and then froze, or was like injured and was crawling out. But I think it's more like, hey, here we are, we're on Earth, and I, you know, pops open the lid. Oops, I took a wrong turn at Albuquerque, and I'm in the middle of the frozen wasteland, and starts walking around. And goes like, well, it's a little too cold. I'm gonna go into epic hibernation now.
Yeah, but how did he get up so high?
Well, the funny word that the guy said has been bringing stuff up from down deep for years now.
Yes. Okay.
I don't know. maybe he was magnetic, or it was magnetic, or glowing, or something. Like, what is the thing that they? What did they even find?
Well,
that thing go?
I think that was the thing that they found at the Norwegian base.
But that looked like a human that had,
yeah, well,
been infected and then started to like turn into a thing.
But infected by that thing.
Yeah, but like, what did the original thing look like?
I don't know. They might have blown it up.
Hmm.
I mean, like we said, it didn't have a default template state, so we don't necessarily know what the first transformation. I mean, I suppose we have to watch the sequel, prequel.
Right, exactly. It's not going to be like an amorphous gaseous blob or something, because like it at least froze and was in a state that they could like carry it in an ice sarcophagus back to their base.
Yeah, I would assume that it is something along the lines of the kinds of creatures we had seen so far. But what's weird about that is they don't seem to have explored that ship, I guess, other than
I kind of wanted to go yeah, into the ship. Like, I wasn't bothered that they didn't. That's, they'll do that in their Prometheus, whether or not that's the prequel or whatever that they did. But yeah, I was like, oh, I want to go in there and find out what's going on.
Yeah, the other thing I kind of want to know is, was the creature actually the pilot of the ship, or was the creature a little buddy on the ship? Like, because we've seen other alien ships that have crashed on planets before, where the pilot of the ship is towing some hazardous cargo. And so it could have been conceivable that this was hazardous cargo, in that there was some other stuff that was dead, like this, that wasn't necessarily the creature's ship. But I mean, my assumption is that it's the creature's ship because it was building its own little flying saucer. Unless it's like, I saw a flying saucer before, I know I could totally build one.
Yeah. If you cut that out, it could have been that this alien found this thing somewhere in the galaxy that it thought was dead and is like, well, that's weird. Let's take this. And then it woke up, killed them. That's why they crashed. And then it snuck out because it never dies.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe the pilot alien is still in the ship, but you never know. These are all things that I'm sure will be explored in the prequel/sequel.
Yep. So on that note, I guess we'll just have to wait and see what happens.
Yeah. The movie should have ended with somebody like setting a bunch of big charges around the spaceship too, to like blow a crack in the tectonic plate so it sinks even further, so nobody can ever run into this stuff ever again. Nuke it from orbit.
The only way to be sure.
Nougat in orbit.
Milky Way.
Third base. Can they take Snickers bars up to the International Space Station?
Why wouldn't they?
I don't know. I don't know if that's a space-approved food.
I don't know what the rules are. But why specifically Snickers?
Let's get nougat.
Yeah, well, so does Milky Way. The Milky Way is more space-appropriate. It has Milky Way in the name. Do you not like it because it has nuts? And Snickers has nuts and
no,
Milky Way doesn't?
I like having a couple extra little things in there. So I like the variety in the Snickers. I like Milky Ways too. I do.
Okay.
I think I liked them first.
Okay. But you definitely prefer the Snickers because it has the peanuts in them.
And I think there's some additional caramel in there.
They both have caramel.
Does the Milky Way have caramel?
Yeah.
Isn't there like a non-caramel Milky Way?
I think there's a dark chocolate Milky Way.
Ugh, gross.
No, that's actually pretty good. Back when I used to get candy for Halloween, anyway.
Not a fan of the dark chocolate.
What?
Yeah.
It's one of the things that's really good about dark chocolate is that you can have it with port, and it tastes delicious.
Of course.
Mm-hmm.
With all of my various ports that I drink.
You put on your smoking jacket and sit in your study and light up your...
My smoking hoodie.
Yeah. Light up your bubble pipe. And start sipping your port and your pieces of dark chocolate.
Some dark chocolate is fine. Most of it is pretty terrible.
Well, it can be a little on the bitter side, but usually also I prefer a dark chocolate truffle where it has stuff inside of it, notably that sweetens the taste. And then you get the contrast of the bitter chocolatey exterior and the creamy, delicious... center.
Is this a metaphor for you? Do you have a bitter chocolatey exterior?
Well, I think I'm pretty bitter throughout. I'm probably more like a dark chocolate bar.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.